Every great film and TV maker began as a red carpet rookie. In this podcast, each episode provides a new conversation with a leading film and TV industry professional, deconstructing their creative career and delving into the life lessons and stories they've picked up along the journey. My name is Mike Battle, a film crew member turned screenwriter, and I'll be your host, and this is Red Carpet Rookies.
I was 24 years old when we went over to make Schindler's List. I didn't know what I was doing.
I have that still. Everything I do, imposter syndrome.
What I learned from Steven Spielberg is just keep going.
Push forward, you know, no matter how bad things get.
And then they casted a young guy named Brad Pitt.
Don't think so much.
Don't take no for an answer.
It was my first meeting with David about Fight Club.
The day that Pixar called, I was ready.
I just picked up the phone and made $500,000.
I mean, at the beginning of every job, I kind of think, what if I don't have any ideas?
Dream come true, working on a Bond film.
I was terrified because I thought, well, what if I just screw this right up?
He said, you'll get a script at the end of the week. It was Titanic.
Hello and welcome to Red Carpet Rookies. Today's guest began his career writing novels informed by his experiences growing up in the troubles of 1970s Northern Ireland, such as The Second Prison, which was shortlisted for the 1991 Irish Times Prize. Soon after, he began writing for television and film, again bringing signature realism to his work in later projects, including Michael Mann's gangster pick Public Enemies, Gunpowder starring Kit Harington, and most notably, his creation of cultural phenomenon Top Boy, for which he was also nominated for a BAFTA. My guest is Ronan Bennett. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Pleasure to be on.
Thank you for being here. Now, Ronan, I ask all of my guests the same first question, and that is, what did your parents do, and did it affect your career choices moving forward?
My parents were separated, so I didn't really ever know my father. My mother was a nurse, and then she got a job in the civil service. And no, neither of her jobs have affected my career, or my choice, my career.
Now, growing up in 1970s Northern Ireland, I imagine, particularly with your parents not doing things in the arts, you probably wouldn't have guessed that maybe you would have made one in yourself. I mean, certainly my Irish grandparents, the way they talked about the arts and careers and things like that, it wasn't necessarily the sort of thing they pushed for. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it was not on the horizon. I went to a pretty good school, and the teachers were ambitious for us. But it was ambitious in the sense of, get to university, that would be good. Not many of my cohort did. It would be, possibly you could get a job as a teacher, something professional. But it was, the horizons weren't, the world was never presented to us as being our oyster. It was realistic. The choices on offer were realistic.
Well, I guess you've mentioned before in some other interviews that you didn't feel necessarily like you grew up as if you had a place at the top table.
Well, I don't think I've ever put it like that, but I grew up in, as I said, I was a single mother looking after two children, myself and my brother. And, it was, looking back on it, it was probably what we would call a difficult, economically challenged household, but it never felt like that at the time. And I always felt there was, I was loved, I was looked after, I was happy. So, I don't think of myself as coming from a really difficult background.
Now, did you write any stories when you were in those younger years? Or was it something that you discovered later? Was it really when you were at your degree that you wrote that first scene?
No, my mother was a great reader, and she used to read to us when we were little children. But she always had her head in a book when she had any free time and wasn't exhausted. And I picked some of that up from her. Some of the I started reading early and really enjoyed it. And then I started to, as a child, I started to invent stories. Obviously they were completely childish. They were. And in one case, particularly embarrassing. I remember being asked to write an essay at school. I would have been at primary school still, and they asked me to write an essay about. I can't even remember the topic, but the first line of it was, "My mother says that when my Aunt Maeve wins at the dogs, she will buy my brother a new pair of shoes." And my mother was horrified, you know, that because my Aunt Maeve used to gamble on the dogs, you know, very modestly.
Yeah.
But to me, that was a story. You know, I could see, I think I might have been a bit of a liar when I was a kid. You know, I'd come home to my mother and tell her things that hadn't happened. You know, it just hadn't happened. And that stuff that I made up about tunnels and being lost and, you know, and she looked at me kind of, what I think I recognized now was that was my writer brain sort of trying stuff out, you know, and seeing the power, even if it's just for a minute or even a few seconds of catching somebody, you know, and just getting their attention through a story, somehow I became aware of that at quite a young age. But the idea of ever becoming a writer, no, that was not going to be possible.
Lovely. Would it be possible to hear the story of the first time you decided to write one of those, I believe it was more like a script type scene when you were studying at university, about your father?
Yes. So I was doing a PhD and I had started the PhD with huge enthusiasm and I thought I would be an academic. It was history. And halfway through it, like many PhD students, I started to fall out of love with what I was doing. And I found myself going back and reading fiction and then starting to think about, was fiction a way to process some of the, you know, more unusual and dramatic things that had happened to me? And one was that, you know, I barely knew my father, but for complicated reasons to do with the Troubles, I ended up in prison. And my father appeared out of nowhere and came to visit me. We had a very brief and difficult visit. And then shortly after that, he died. I mean, within a few days, he died. And I wanted to kind of, I guess the word is process. I mean, I've never done therapy. I don't, you know, I never felt the need to do anything like that. But processing it in a fictional way was useful to me. And I wrote that scene, which became a scene in the second prison and my first novel, and just expanded. It went from there. And then, you know, that's when the lies came in, you know. anyway, so that was how I started writing, you know, properly.
Do you begin all of your works from a place of truth, realism, or can it come from anywhere?
I'd like to come from anywhere, but I mean, there are things that, I mean, I've just seen Barbie, as like everybody's seen Barbie. I go, wow, that's really, really interesting. I could never in a million years have written that script. You know, I just don't think I'm made to do something like that. You know, I have my thing, I have my world, and that's what I write about.
Absolutely. Speaking of your world, the most famous one of them is, of course, Hackney and Top Boy. And I'm sure you've heard it many times and you're used to it, is people are often surprised that you are a white Irish man who wrote Top Boy. But I thought it was really interesting to hear Ashley Waters saying that he thought you were the perfect person to write it in many ways because you were living in Hackney as that outsider looking in. Could you talk to that?
Well, I think that in some ways, obviously on the surface, it's strange, but I come from a community in Ireland that was, you know, that was vilified and was targeted by this, you know, by the state, that it was seen as being outside the norms. It was seen as dangerous and, you know, barely civilized in some respects. So for me, when I came to London and I saw what was happening with black people, I kind of went, wait a minute. You know, sort of, obviously I'm not black. You know, their experience is very different, but there was something that I recognized. So that's, you know, that's always been an area of interest for me, you know, politically, historically, and culturally. And then, you know, then it happened. Then I saw this kid right around the corner from my house early in the morning, like when he should have been at school, selling drugs. And it just went from there.
Interesting. I don't know. I know you have children yourself, and it's interesting. My father grew up in London to Irish parents. from the Republic. And he said, it's very interesting watching us grow up, because my generation have grown up with Ireland being this, oh, it's so great to be Irish. Brilliant. Everybody loves the Irish, blah, blah, blah. But he had that experience growing up through the 70s where it's like you're at school and it is difficult. And it, exactly as you said, it's not quite what it's become now. And it's a very difficult time. And I totally understand that.
No, I mean, no, your father's generation, my generation, coming to London in the 70s, Irish people were not looked on as being cool or interesting or, they were looked on as potentially dangerous. And there was a lot of suspicion.
Hmm.
So that was the connection, you know, looking at what was going on with the black community and the sus laws as they were at the time, and the anti-terrorism laws for the Irish people. And there was some kind of connection there. So that's kind of where it came from. I mean, there's a long, long, we could do a whole separate podcast about Top Boy, but there's a long, long story of how that came to screen and, you know, the process I went through to research it and write it. But all writers follow their own obsessions. And writers who, you know, are trying to say something, writing on a particular show because that's your job, you know, that's completely fine. But if you're, you know, if you're trying, like I always try to say something in whatever script I write, make a comment on the world, then the connection between, you know, my own obsessions as a writer and the world around me and my immediate neighborhood of Hackney started to formulate. And I started to think of, you know, okay, can we get in, you know, can we get into this world? Can we, you know, how can we see it? But it started with that awareness and connection that comes from Ireland.
Amazing. You mentioned the research process there. What did you learn about writing a world that wasn't necessarily entirely yours? Because that's something that writers struggle with, particularly these days. They might be really interested in a topic and have a way in, like yourself, but it's a difficult thing to approach, and you've done it so famously well. I'd love to know any lessons, listening and stuff you've learned along the way, really.
Well, on the general point of, you know, what should writers write about? The thing is, I come down on the side of writers being free to write and explore whatever they want. I mean, the minute we start saying, no, you're not this, or you're not that, so you can't write about this, or you can't write about that, that's a road to nowhere. And so I'm really unapologetically in favor of writers exploring whatever they want to explore. That said, it has to be done with respect. It has to be done in a way that isn't exploitative. And it has to be real. It has to be authentic. With something as sensitive as going into the a completely different world, the Hackney black world, that, you know, it requires it. First of all, research. You need to go. You need to find people. You need to talk to people. You need to win their trust. It mustn't be exploitative on any level. You've got to listen to what they say. You can't start with your own preconceptions and say, I want you to say this so that I can write that, which I've already decided. You have to truly listen and just be respectful.
You mentioned the authenticity there, and something that I haven't heard you speak too much about is Public Enemies that you did for Michael Mann. And I read in an interview, he was saying that he wanted to bring you on because he felt that you would understand John Dillinger in a way, even though the culture wasn't something that was your upbringing. Could you talk to that project? And obviously he was a hero of yours as well.
He was. I mean, I first became aware of Michael Mann through a little known movie of his called The Jericho Mile. It's set in a prison, and I saw it just shortly after I came out of prison for the last time. And it really made a huge impact on me. And the Public Enemy started in the way that so many of these things start, is, you know, you get a call or an email from your agent or a producer. And just as Michael Mann's going to reach out to you to talk to you about Public Enemies. And I thought, oh, this sounds good. And I went over and, you know, to LA and talked to Michael about it. We talked about how to do it. And, actually it was one of the easier processes. I think it was probably 3 years, from the first conversation to being on screen, or maybe 3 years from first conversation to being principal photography, which is, you know, it's quite quick. I mean, some projects I've been involved in have taken literally 10 years to get from that first conversation to screen. So you have to have stamina in this business as a writer. You have to have stamina, and you have to have more than one horse in the race, which is to say, you can't just be working on one project all the time and see if that works, because, you know, it just takes too long for these things to happen. So you need to be working on 2, 3, 4 things more or less simultaneously, and just see which horse comes in.
That's very good advice. Did you tell Michael your Jericho project connection?
I'm pretty sure I did. I think I did. And I think he was quite surprised, because, you know, I think that was Michael's first, it was a television film, but it had a small theatrical release in Europe. I don't think it was theatrically released in the US. And so for him, it's probably a minor piece at the beginning of his, you know, way back in the beginning of his career, and not something people think of Michael Mann, they think of Last of the Mohicans and Heat and so on. They don't think of the Jericho Mile. So it probably surprised him.
Very cool. How was your experience writing for Hollywood like that compared to maybe the British system?
I've only done two Hollywood projects, and you know, one was made and one wasn't. So honestly, it was wasn't a lot different, really. You know, I think as a writer, as a screenwriter, there are many writers who feel that, you know, the studio and the executives are kind of out to get you, and that the producers will screw you over. And, you know, and so they get contracted to do one draft and one set of revisions, or maybe two drafts and two sets of revisions, and then they're out, and then they get another writer in, and so on. And that does definitely happen. But I try to see the executives as not as enemies, not as people to be fought. I mean, usually they're smart people. Usually they're trying to help you to get your project made, because that's in their interests. You know, if they've brought you on as a writer, they want you to do well. It reflects on them. So, and they have jobs as well. This probably isn't a very popular thing to say among writers, but executives, they have careers and they have jobs. And, you know, if the writer doesn't deliver, literally doesn't deliver the script, or it's very late, or doesn't deliver in terms of quality, it reflects on them as well. And they have, you know, they're workers, they have jobs. So I try to work as collaboratively as possible with, you know, with studio executives and all of that. You know, just and I would say to other, you know, newer writers, try not to get into that mental framework of seeing them as the enemy. You know, try to work with them, hold fast to your vision, argue for you. You know, when there are points that you really think that they've gone astray and they're trying to lead you astray, you've got to stand your ground. But try not to see it as a doomsday battle. You know, try to work with them. And anyway, that's plenty of people have different experiences. And writers, you put a group of writers together, and they will very quickly start bitching about studios and executives and so on.
Well, I guess that runs through all of your work. I mean, Top Boy famously is collaborative with those revisions on the script and things like that. You're not necessarily precious in the way some people are, maybe, or maybe I'm wrong about your words exactly on the page.
Well, it depends on the script, and it depends on the project. With Top Boy, the dialogue, I mean, listen, by the way, writing a screenplay is so much more than about dialogue. The dialogue revision, for example, is the easiest part of the process. And some people do think that, you know, some actors might think, you know, oh, I changed that line and I wrote the script.
Yeah.
You know, actually creating a screenplay that takes you from A to Z and takes you through those three acts and builds to a satisfying ending, something that's writing. I mean, knowing how to structure a story, knowing where the peaks and troughs are, and the climaxes and the reverse, and all of that, that's complicated. The dialogue part of it is actually, once you're writing the dialogue, you're on the home straight. On Top Boy, clearly the actors know the language, the street language, better than I do. So I say, this is what the scene is about. This is the meaning of the words. If you can find a better way to say it, say it. And, you know, bring your poetry, bring the street poetry to the script. But if it's something else, if it was Gunpowder, for example, which I wrote in a sort of semi-17th century version of English, you know, that's a completely different experience. Similarly with Day of the Jackal, which we're shooting now. And, you know, no, then it's very different.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you make. And I find this, talking about my own very early screenwriting career compared to yours, where people say, oh, you know, come up with a few ideas and send that over to the production company. That takes so much time because you've got to do all of that world building. You've got to structure it. And I try to explain to my friends that writing is arguably like the easy bit, like the bit you think of sitting and typing it out on the script, because you've done the structure, you've done the characters, and all of that stuff is ready, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I think that, to summarize, you know, writing is much, much, much more than dialogue.
Absolutely. Now, to wrap up on Red Carpet Rookies, Ronan, I like to do a little quick fire, which is my own ode to In the Actor's Studio. So if you could say what comes into the top of your head first would be amazing, if that's okay.
Right.
Now, the first one is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
That a screenwriter has to be a rewrite man or woman. The amount of rewriting involved, it just never stops. I mean, I know this is quick fire and you can edit out, but I always think of screenplays as like you're playing tennis against Alcaraz or Djokovic, and you lob your script over the net and you just hope it never comes back. But there, you know, it comes back and it keeps coming. You write and it keeps coming back, and there's no point in getting upset about it. Scripts will come back, and you've got to be prepared to rewrite. And if it does your head in, or if you're not prepared to do that, then you shouldn't be writing screenplays.
Excellent advice. And do not worry about the fact it's quickfire. That's really good to hear. Number two, do you have a favorite film or maybe just one that impacted you a lot other than The Jericho Project?
The Jericho Mile. But the other one that, again, not a really well-known film, but deserves to be, is The Year of Living Dangerously. It was directed by Peter Weir in the early 1980s. And the reason I like it so much is that it mixes politics and the personal. And it does it in a fantastic setting. It's Indonesia during a coup in 1964, I think. And it's an Australian journalist played by Mel Gibson, who, by the way, it's a young Mel Gibson, and he is fantastic in it, and Sigourney Weaver. And it's a terrific film, and, you know, it's about something, and it's also romantic. It's romantic, and yeah, it's an important movie.
Amazing. Number three, which job in the industry would you do if you weren't doing yours?
I would be director. You know, and there was a time when I thought I might do that, but I actually wrote a short script for myself to direct. It was called Do Armed Robbers Have Love Affairs? And it was financed. The BBC financed it. And I was, you know, okay. They said, okay, when do you want to shoot this? And I looked at it and I thought, do I really want to be a director? And in the end, I passed, and we got Brian Kirk, who's now shooting, literally as we speak today, he's shooting Day of the Jackal in Budapest. And so Brian came to my house. We talked about it. And I said, Brian, you know what? You do this. So I sort of chickened out on that. And I sometimes wonder what would have happened had I not. But anyway.
That's good self-knowledge to know that maybe it wasn't right for you.
Or Cardus.
Number four, if you could work with one person living or dead, who would it be? Sorry.
Well, there's a few, but Orson Welles would have been fun. You know, I think it would have been insane, but it would have been fun. And then I sometimes think of what would a writer's room with Raymond Chandler and F. Scott Fitzgerald have been like, you know, because all those writers went to Hollywood and anyway. So
that'd be a good movie.
Yeah.
Number five, this is going to be a hard one for you. What is a book that everyone should read? You can make it career focused if that narrows it down.
Well, I can't really think of one, except I was asked by Robert Cooper, after I published my first novel, I was asked by a producer at the BBC called Robert Cooper to a meeting. I went and met him, and he said, would you like to write a screenplay? And I said, yeah, of course. And I met him at BAFTA, and I turned, after the meeting was over, I went into Hatchard's bookshop, and I bought Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman, which I still is the only book on screenwriting I've ever read. And I think it's very good. So I would, specifically to do with the business, I would recommend William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Lovely stuff. And finally, if you won an Oscar, who would you thank, Ronan?
I'm not even going to go there.
Okay, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for sharing your stories. It's been fantastic. Your advice is incredible.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Red Carpet Rookies. To help us grow and be able to interview more amazing film and TV professionals, please do subscribe and drop us a rating on the Apple Podcast Store on your iPhone or online if you're an Android user. If you're interested in regular updates, the best thing you can do is to join our mailing list at redcarpetrookies.com or alternatively, find us on Instagram at redcarpetrookies or Twitter at rcrookiespod. I also tweet regularly about my own learnings in the business at Mike F. Battle on Twitter, so please do come and say hi. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time.